and welcome to Tiny Voice Talks with me, Tori Bono. And today I'm joined by Heather Lucas again. Now, if you haven't caught up with the first episode, you must, because we're talking about moving away from rewards and punishments. We were originally only doing one episode, but actually there's so much to this that we're going to do a second one today. The first episode, catch up with it. You'll hear us talk about the three R's. We talk about two R's. We're going to be carrying on with the third R today. You'll hear us talking about Dr. Bruce Perry, about a positive psychology. There's so much. Honestly, there's so much in that first episode. So if you're listening to this and you haven't listened to the first one, press stop, go and listen to the first one, and then come back and join us. Now, Heather, I am so excited that you are back with me today. So welcome back.
Hi, thank you for having me back for a second one. It's very exciting to do two.
I know. Well, I felt like you left me on a cliffhanger in a sense, because what happened was that we've pressed stop and then you said, oh my goodness, actually we didn't cover this and we didn't cover this and we didn't cover this. And I thought, oh, I need to know about those things. So that's why I sort of grabbed you to come straight back to record them. Now, for anyone that hasn't tuned in the first one, hopefully everyone has now, Heather, but you are SEM support, but you've also got a background in psychology, haven't you?
Yes, I've worked in primary schools for quite a long time, probably about 15 years now. I'm losing track. That's how long. I worked in a nursery before that, and I did my psychology degree part-time over 6 years whilst working as a teaching assistant and combined the two. And I've always taken on anything I can, self-taught, courses that are available, and I've gathered a body of knowledge in my head and experience out there in schools.
And that body of knowledge, I mean, I love talking to you because you do have this vast body of knowledge that I think, you know, for me as a practicing teacher, it is so interesting listening to you, because I listen to you and then, you know, I go into my classroom and I can act on exactly what you've said or look at my children with different lenses. Now, you left me, as I said, on a bit of a cliffhanger last time because we'd covered the three R's. We'd talked about the three R's. We talked about regulate, relate and reason. But then you said to me, actually, do you know what? We didn't really cover reason that much. So where are we starting today, Heather?
Well, I'd love to say that we're going to be really, really neat and tidy about this. But to be honest, it's a model, yeah, and it's a, okay. I use it in my head. And it's a sequential model. It's for, you know, those of us that are hopefully up to date now, it's Dr. Bruce Perry's three R's of reaching the learning brain, starting with the fact we need to prioritise emotional regulation. We need to then get the relationship into a safe, trusting place before we can even move into that reflective learning space, which, you know, teachers are good at. By the time we get up there, teachers teach, you know, and as a teaching assistant and a specialist in SEM as I am now, I always say, nah, it's teacher stuff. Don't know it. Talk to me about phonics. I'm like, nah, that's teacher stuff. I don't need to spend too long on reason in terms of teaching, because that's what you all know how to do. But there are quite a lot of things about how we stay in that reason space. And we need to be aware of the fact that we don't suddenly leave behind emotional regulation and our relationship. You with me? They are ever present. And I think that's really important. So so one of the things that I'd like to start with today is actually a bit of a flip back to emotional regulation, which talk quite a bit about. Because one of the things that I didn't talk about is another number and another letter. There's a six R's here, okay, just to confuse everybody, okay. And again, Bruce Perry has come up with these. The six R's of sensory somatic regulation, because these R's are the principles behind what has been found scientifically and empirically to be regulating for the human body, human autonomic system. And actually, I think that as practitioners, it's really important that we actually start to think about, you know, I'm all for reflecting on things and reframing things and looking at things slightly different, newer perspectives, not getting stuck, not being dichotomous, not being too black and white, not being either chaotic or rigid. I'm into all of that. But actually, we need to have an awareness of what underpins some of these things. So a person could come and say, right, you know, I'm going to do some training for you guys today on how to regulate a child. And they might say, right, we can use wobble cushions, we can use fiddle toys, we can use a balance board. And you could have this whole list, this whole lovely menu of all of these wonderful tools. But if you don't really understand why you're using them, they're probably not going to be that effective. So the six R's of sensory somatic regulation are the principles that need to be in place for things to be rewarding, regulating. Sorry, you can tell what the first one is going to be regulating. So I think it's really important to just to add that in and float that background in.
That's really interesting, actually, because from a teaching perspective, I've taught many children, as you know, and I've been given various tools to use with various children. One of the ones that I found trickiest, if I'm honest with you, is the fiddle toys, which my Senko at school calls the fiddle tools. We don't call them toys, we call them tools, because she's very clear that they aren't toys, they are tools. But actually, you know, I'm really hoping that you're going to unpick through the six R's exactly why they're tools and not toys.
Yes, and I love the fact that we shouldn't call them toys as well. I actually have developed a contract. So when a child and I decide that something might be helpful in class, we talk about how it might be helpful and why and how it might be used and whatever. Then we just decide that we'll have an experiment to see. And that makes it more conscious for the child as well.
Yeah.
And we also are very respectful of the fact that we need to now go and propose our case to the teacher because it's their classroom. I never impose things like that into a classroom because if the teacher doesn't quite get it or isn't really, you know, in that space for it right now, it won't necessarily be helpful. And many a fiddle toy has added to stress and added to distraction, as we all know.
That's a really good idea. And it's interesting. We've got another Senko in school and she was bringing around various different fiddle tools. This was last year. And what she did was she actually said to one of my children, what I'd like you to do is I'd like you to investigate which one works best for you. And then feedback exactly what you think. And actually the child felt that, you know, they were sort of a bit of a scientist working out and investigating, you know, what was the best. And I think if approaching it like that seemed to work really well as opposed to, oh, you just fiddle with it.
Absolutely. Children are naturally scientists. Because if you think about it, interesting about the child on the high chair, why they drop their spoon and the food goes splat and the spoon makes a sound. And you wipe it up and you give it back to them and then they do it again, you know. So they're not actually relating to you in that moment and going, I really want to give us some extra work to do today. They're actually just kind of working out cause and effect. We are born to be scientists. We're born to find out about the world. And if we can engage that, it's much more healthy. And then I think as well, you're engaging the part of the child that is really starting to evaluate what are our objectives here, but without it being too highbrow and too language and to adult led. I always encourage them to see it as an experiment of which they are part, and then we can collaborate, which comes up in reason. Once we get to reason, a big part of making reason works is to collaborate and working as a side. We've jumped straight back up to reason. They are all interlinked.
We have, haven't we?
Yeah, they're all interlinked. And it's about seeing, for me, it's about seeing the sequence in your head and just allowing yourself to slide up and down, not separating them out too distinctly. Because that's not how life works.
That makes complete sense. Okay, so I've got the R's written in my book. I've got R. I'm ready. Okay. Go. Tell me the six R's.
Things that are scientifically supported to be regulating for the body and the autonomic system tend to be things that are rhythmic, patterned. Okay, that's one.
This is where every single listener is going, oh, rhythm. How do I spell rhythm? It might not be, but.
Yeah, R-H-Y.
Yeah.
It's one of those ones that I had to spell
for, you know, practice spelling for years. But yes, carry on. Sorry. Sorry.
That old silent H.
Side. Yes. So rhythmic.
Yeah, rhythmic. Repetitive.
Ooh.
And predictable, because I'm giving you the subset word just to help you frame it a little bit. Repetitive in terms of predictable. And you can think of that in terms of, you can put that in with rhythm very easily. Obviously, one of the things that you can do as a whole class is to just have a tapping game on the table, and you tap out a rhythm and they all tap it back. But then you can actually make it relational. Here we go with another one. A relational needs to be attuned and connected. And you could do the tapping game, and you're obviously relating to your whole class in that moment. You're judging who's the most hyper, who's the most hypo, where's the average in the middle. So you wouldn't necessarily do a super fast, excited rhythm if that's not what you were going for. You know, whatever you want. If you want them to get more hyper or come down, you change your rhythm. But then you would ask somebody else to take the rhythm, and they would set it. And that child now is involved in relating to their whole class, because they're in the serve and return, which I mentioned last time. They're now serving the rhythm to the class. Yeah. And they hear that rhythm come back, and that's the return. So they're psychologically now related, and they belong, and they're safe. That's psychologically where it puts them, yeah? Mm-hmm. I'm not saying, obviously, it's like a switch that just quickly, you know. But the attuned bit's really important, because if you've got a class that have gone off the wall, they're not going to just suddenly do a particular tool, like I say, with the wobble cushions. The patterns on the table is just the same. You have to attune it to where you're at and use it to move it gradually to where you need it to be. Now are you ready for the next one? In a respectful way.
Nice.
Unconditional positive regard. So when I say you need to move it where you want it to be, if it isn't respectful of the needs of the other, then it won't be regulating. So basically, if it's all about your needs, and your needs are dominant, then that's a disconnect.
Yeah.
So that won't be regulating.
Yeah, that makes complete sense.
Then relevant is another one. Mm-hmm. To the stage, the developmental stage that you're dealing with, not the age you've got in front of you.
Mm.
The developmental stage, not the chronological age. So relevant to the developmental stage that you are dealing with, and whether that's an individual child or you and a group in a whole class situation. And again, with a group, you've got your parameters of your hyper at the top, your hypo at the bottom, and where's the balance in the middle that you're trying to manage. What stage are we at? You know, if we're bringing them all down, you know, the whole thing about the spider on the ceiling. I saw a lovely tweet the other day. There was a spider on the ceiling in my class today. The children noticed it and went back to listening to me and taking their copious notes as they always do. No, I'm lying. It was pandemonium and complete chaos. And I smiled and I was just like, yeah, you know how like when it's windy or there's a spider or something in it, and everybody just gets a bit. And some classes will roll with that much more than others.
Mm.
You know, one of the first classes I worked in was a bit of a baptism of fire, because we had three hyper children in the same class. And I remember the one day I was sitting at the back, they were on the carpet for carpet time, so they were on the floor. And one of them went up in the air, like physically. And I thought, oh, we've got a trigger there. And I just knew the next two were about to follow. And boy, do they. Do you know what I mean? Well, of course, yeah. Then the next ones on the list who are likely to be stimulated by a hyperreaction start to get a bit agitated. And before you know it, you've got that, as you know, that sort of contagion.
It's like the domino effect. It really is. It was
absolutely. I don't think there's a teacher listening who won't know of it, is there?
No, it was interesting, actually. We were in an assembly the other day. And the children were watching a video, and it was a video that had been chosen to, you know, to inspire, etc., with regards to the theme. And they were watching it, and one child laughed. And then it was like a domino effect across the whole of the assembly, and all the children started laughing. Now, I've got to say, the video wasn't amusing. And I turned to another teacher. And I said, do you think they know why they're laughing? And he went, no, it's just that thing. It's like the domino effect.
Social contagion.
Yeah, it was really interesting to watch. And then, you know, the laughing finished relatively quickly, etc. But it was just that thing, and I watched it. And you're absolutely right, it does. There are those moments that you have, whether it's in an assembly or in your class, whatever, where it just happens and you think, oh, gosh. What's occurred? Rain. I find rain does it. When you suddenly get a downpour out the window and it's like we've never seen rain in our lives before.
You know? Compounded by the fact you're about to have a wet break.
Yeah. Oh, I hate those things. Oh, yeah. Any teacher listening will probably hate wet breaks as much as I do. They're just...
Yeah, I think everybody... I think we need to do regulating exercise now, because anybody listening has immediately become more stressed.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, I think we all need to do a bit of deep breathing.
So what's the last R? I've got relevance to development.
Yeah, the last R is rewarding and pleasurable.
Ah, yeah, okay, that makes sense.
If it is unpleasant, it cannot be safe.
I had a child who really didn't find the wobble cushion comfortable. So therefore, it wasn't rewarding or pleasurable to use a wobble cushion, because it was just, she found it really uncomfortable. So that for her wasn't a good choice, was it?
No, I think one of the... Now, this is not my speciality. We've talked about this. But the sensory stuff is something I'm more interested in learning all about, because I've realised how fundamental it is. But yeah, that's more to do with your sensory feedback. And some of us have hypo, you know, the low and the high, hypo sensory feedback. And some of us have hyper sensory feedback. And that can be in different domains. And that's where it gets complex. So if you actually are somebody who doesn't feel where you are in the world, you know, you just need a bit more feedback from your chair, and it helps you realize where you're at in the world. But if she was somebody who was hyper regulated or hypo regulated for different reasons, do you know what I mean? Like sound, do you know what I mean? I did that once. I sit with this boy. I was so excited that I was, you know, getting my head around all this stuff. And this young pupil was telling me that he was finding it hard, difficult to concentrate in class. And teacher was saying, oh, always wandering around and oh. And I just said, you know what? I said, tell you what, shall we try, me and my, you know, collaboration and scientist and sensory stuff, we'll try a pod for you in the back of the classroom, so that whenever it comes to independent work, you can go and sit in the pod and you can have it completely clear, or your special things, that whatever work works for you. And then it's your little space and you can sit. And this child just calmly sat there and sort of slid their eyes sideways to me, as if I really wasn't on this planet, and said, I'd still be able to hear everybody though.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh yeah, okay. Yeah. I got so carried away with this idea that he was getting distracted visually, because I'm quite visual. So yes, it's very uniquely individual. We all have profiles, and you know, there are some general principles like the six R's I've just talked about that you can keep in mind, because they're likely to come in somewhere for all of us. But also on top of that, yes, there will be individual specialities as well.
Now, actually, this is a shout out, call out request for anyone out there listening who is an occupational therapist. Could you get in touch with me? Because I would love, and we were talking about this before we started recording, Heather and I would love to interview an occupational therapist, because actually I think sensory profiles are a really complex thing that we don't know enough about. So I would love to interview and learn from an occupational therapist. And that, did you find the exact name of the person I needed, Heather?
Yeah, the two that I know of are, they're titled, because this, like, as you know, this is not my area. The two that I know that I've talked to are specialist paediatric occupational therapists.
Yes. So ideally, that's what I'd love a specialist paediatric occupational therapist, because I think we all have so much to learn from you. Now, Heather, going back to you, because we are learning lots from you right now. So we have got our six R's for regulation. Now, are we moving on to reason now?
No. Yes. No.
We are. No. I know they're all connected. That this is
yes,
it's the sliding scale. No, I'm getting they're all connected. I've drawn scales and everything on my book here. But
so, yes, we are moving up, but I would like to move up through a little side avenue as well. So one of the things that I'd like to mention now is I am looking at a book in front of me on restorative practice. Now, this is relational, mm-hmm. but it's also how we bring reason in. Okay, it's not the mm-hmm. only way to do it. It's not the only way at all. The book that I'm looking at in front of me is by Mark Finnis, who some of you may have heard of, and he does great training and has got a website. And restorative practice, if you listen to Mark, could also be called relational practice. And actually, restorative practice, like many things, and off this recording, we have talked about things that get misused misinterpreted and then get maligned. And I think the word restorative is one of those that has gone down that path sometimes. It's been misused. It's been misappropriated. But if you think of it as a relational practice, of which there are structures that may be used, it's sort of something that can't be really misunderstood. It's just how do we use it? And that's obviously always, always key. The quality of how we use something is always the defining factor. You know, just like going back to the wobble cushion and the fiddle toys tools.
Yeah.
So one of the things that I think is a nice little link between us going back to regulate, moving through to reason, is Mark talks about the social discipline window. And it's a little bit hard because obviously he has it drawn out. It's the traditional, you know, window with four corners, you know, four panels, and the sort of the graph, you know, and it's about how much challenge is involved in the situation and how much support. So if you've got low challenge and low support, you're in the bottom left corner of the window.
Yeah.
That's the not section. Yeah. There's no support and there's no challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, that can be called neglect because there's no interaction, there's no relationship, there's nothing. If you go up the challenge to the one above that, but you're still in low support, that's where you're doing stuff to children. So you're telling children that they need to do this, they need to do that, you know?
Yeah.
And I've heard that so many times. You know, I've got a child outside in a hedge who's not coming in. And a member of staff inside, but they need to come in. It's not safe out there, or they need to learn maths. They need to. I had a child, I think I might have mentioned the child last time, who ran out of maths with their maths book. And they said, but they need to listen to the input because otherwise they won't know what they're doing. And that child just ended up running out of the classroom and left the maths book behind.
Mm.
So, you know, that's your high challenge, but no support. They need to. Your low challenge, high support is when you do everything for them. And sometimes it's good to reflect on, I touched on this earlier as well, in terms of relationship, where are the balance of needs here? Sometimes we need to actually reflect on our own needs. The two is very much full of our own needs, and I think it's obviously so. We need them to sit there because I've got to achieve, and I haven't got the band space to leave the classroom or whatever. You know, it's quite easy to see what our needs are there and how we're imposing them on a child. I think sometimes we get stuck in the fact that actually maybe that's not okay,
mm-hmm.
Culturally accepted. But when we move to the four section, one of the little vignettes that pops to my mind is, you know, the wonderful, kind, cuddly teaching assistant who's the sweetest person and does everything for this particular child.
Yeah. It becomes a learned helplessness, I think, with the child. I've seen that happen where they can't function unless they've got an adult with them. And actually, on a similar but slightly different note, so this isn't so much emotional, but I remember finding it very frustrating when I'd have adults in the room that would write something on a whiteboard for a child to copy, and the child didn't know what it was they were writing. They just knew they had to copy, and it's set in a, and again, it's the same emotionally. You know, if a child is just being told what to do and they're doing it, but they don't understand why they're doing it, then they aren't learning.
And this reminds us of our first conversation where we started and we specifically used the example of rewards and consequences.
Yeah.
Because rewards and consequences just happen around me and I'm just trying to shape my behaviour to sort of match what feels the easiest. But I'm not really critically working on myself or, you know, that in any wider perspective. I'm not learning. I'm just doing.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk about the top box, which is high challenge, high support. What does that look like? Because that's clearly the most effective, but what does it look like?
Well, on this model, they put with in this block.
Ah.
And when I talk about the three R's, and I have a flowchart that I use with the families that I support, I talk about collaboration.
Mm.
Dr. Ross Green talks about collaboration. So, you know, you're getting a feel for the fact that this is a meeting of minds. We've established a trusting, safe relationship at this point. So now we're going to use that trusting, safe relationship.
Yes.
And you will find children are so astute when we actually get to what I call the sweet spot. This is the sweet spot. If you've managed to get to this sweet spot, you'll know it. It's a completely different place to be. And you can just look and you can say to a child, is this fiddle tool helping? And they'll go, no, I just like it. And you'll go, yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You can collaborate and you can make, and they will, and you go, well, okay. So how else can we, you know, work on this, you know? And yeah. It's just a completely different feel.
I really like that. I like the fact that actually that high challenge, high support is actually collaboration. It is a powerful way of actually getting children to understand and engage with the process without the adult sort of
imposing.
Yeah, absolutely. Love that. Okay, take me on. Where are we going next? I'm not even going to try and lead this conversation because where are you taking me to?
So basically, we are now in we can't leave behind the emotional regulation and we can't leave behind the relationship because they are still hugely key to the moment that we're in. But we are now in reasoning with a child or a class. You can do this with a group as well. There's an exchange of energies when you're in front of a class that you can hold your energy and you can communicate to a whole class in a similar way. It's just more complex because obviously it's a slightly different dynamic. But now we're in that with place, that reason place. We're in a really powerful place because we can now influence the child because the child will trust us. We are attuned to them. That's part of the relationship bit. So we're not necessarily able to get them to do algebra for an hour behind a desk right now. You with me? That's not attuned. And they wouldn't trust us if that you know expectation was too high for their stage anyway. But from that, we then, and teachers listening will have heard of the, is it Zygotsky and his framework?
Yes.
And his zone of proximal development. So we apply all of these lovely theories like zone of proximal development. And what we don't learn in early career teaching is about how to interact with people in the ways that I'm talking about, how to actually get children and colleagues even into a place where we can collaborate, which is a real sadness to me. But what we do learn in early career teaching is modules like the zone of proximal development. But what I'm saying is you can apply that same thinking now to this. So what's the next thing that is achievable for this child that is actually still the next step on? We're introducing some challenge now. If we overdo it, we'll lose them. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What is the next bit for them? What chunk can they do? And we can lead them into that. And we will also probably find that we are able to increase their tools as they do that. So, for example, we're going to be teaching them, and that's by modelling, communicating, and actual overt teaching, depending on your moment with your child, or their cognitive ability, etc. We're going to be teaching them insight about their own feelings and behaviours, so that they can start to own them for themselves.
Yeah.
We're going to be teaching them through modelling and, you know, actual teaching, empathy. You know, we're going to start bringing these things in, especially if this is a child who has these particular gaps in their skill map.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you might have a child who got dysregulated, but actually when they're back on board, they've got all of this. Great, you know.
Yeah.
But these are some of the things that don't forget we might actually be teaching, you know. And we can go about things in a way whereby we hold them in this position. So we can reframe a no into a yes, but with conditions.
Mm-hmm.
Or like we were saying before, yes, we could try that as an experiment, I wonder. Because then they can go through the process with you. And they can come back to it and go, yeah, okay, so the objectives that you were talking about weren't met, only mine were. And then I can be like, yeah, so can you see how that worked for you but didn't work for everybody else?
Yeah.
And then they can start to build that understanding and that empathy and own it, and it's safe to own it, and it's safe to go, okay. Oh, I think at this point, the next chunk is how do we now do something that's okay for you and for others?
Yeah.
We need to be creative, emphasizing positives, because there's a lot of negative bias out there in ourselves. We always reflect on yourself first. Positives should never be used in terms of being toxic positivity. Toxic positivity is ignoring difficult stuff. Oh, come on, you'll be fine. Oh, you did it yesterday. What's the problem? It'll be okay. Just smile. That's toxic positivity if it's overdone, because it ignores the difficult stuff. And the difficult stuff has nowhere to go. And in terms of our sense of self, and in terms of our ability to learn how to regulate ourselves and own all of our tricky stuff, that's really, really unhealthy. But we do have a negative bias naturally, because we're more designed to put threat, because that's more urgent. You know, if there's a threat coming towards us at the same time as something really, really safe and rewarding, we need to make sure that we can't ignore the threat. Otherwise, you know, in evolution terms, it doesn't make sense. So we do have a negative bias. So positivity is needed, because those children, especially with a lot of emotional dysregulation, have become so hypervigilant to their surroundings in terms of threat that they have no bandwidth at all for absorbing positives. Like, some of them have literally no bandwidth left. So we have to help them start to build that. I think of it as a muscle, you know, that actually, yeah, okay, that felt tricky, but look at this. This was, and help them really absorb that and file that. And that can be really challenging with some really emotionally dysregulated children. But this, remember, as well as a teacher, you can be using on a class basis, on a spectrum. So you're going to have, on a class basis, you're going to have children who are not traumatized, hypervigilant at that far end. You're going to have children who are tending towards a negative bias. So the awareness of balancing that out is really important, but avoiding toxic positivity. We can only move into absorbing our positives, you know, if we also feel that we know we're safe.
Yeah.
The other thing I would say that we need to hold in our toolbox is the power of the pause. She says pausing.
Well, I'm a great one for that. I think I've really learned that in the coaching room. Interestingly, I've learned the power of silence, the power of actually not jumping in. I've noticed that I'll ask a child a question, and before I learned the power of the pause and the power of silence, I would jump in with the next question or an answer to the question I'd just asked, as opposed to actually giving that child a moment. And I think it's so important, that power of just stopping. And I think actually, let's move away from children for a moment. I think it's so important with adults as well, that actually we allow people the space to just have a silent moment to think, as opposed to it being a quick to and fro conversation, because my brain doesn't work like that. I don't know about yours, but I need that moment to stop and reflect and think about an answer to a question, as opposed to, I'm asking a question, give me an answer right now.
So obviously I need to pause.
Not at all. But do you know what I mean? It's just really interesting.
Well, I struggle with this one. So my personal reflection is that I live in my head, which is what I'm working on. My personal growth is getting out of my head sometimes. I love words and language. And when I'm passionate, I get faster and faster and faster, as you will have seen a bit of in both of these podcasts. So this one is one that I need to hold dear, because it's so important that I don't find myself in that space. And when I am in the sweet spot, I have a different feel about me. And actually, I was speaking to a supervisor once, and I was talking about stuff that was going on in my own life that was super stressful at the time. And then I started to talk about, you know, the children in my caseload and who I was with. And she stopped me and she smiled and she went, "Do you know what?" She said, "I don't see it here, but I think you're really different when you're talking to those children." And it was a real moment for me.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, do you know what? Yeah, I am sometimes. But I have to be careful that I am in that space and I'm not in my busy, talkative, slightly fast, you know, everything, loads of knowledge space. So, yeah, it's definitely one that I have to check in with. But, you know, a pause is where processing happens, and that's learning happening in front of your eyes in silence, you know.
But I think what I've unpicked through the work that I've done with the coaching is that, in a sense, we are trained from a very, very young age about how to communicate. And a lot of that communication is fast, two-way conversation. And you say this, and I'm going to say this, the related statement, so that you think you know that I've listened to you, if that makes sense to you. And it's really interesting because I've had to relearn how I communicate with people. Because what I've recognized is that some of the ways that I've been communicating with people have actually been ineffective. And when I've brought that into my classroom with the children, what I've noticed is that when I'm not trying to have a quick two-way conversation with the child, when I'm allowing that space to envelop both the child and I, when I'm creating that safe space, that actually leads to much more powerful, purposeful conversations and dialogue than the sort that I was doing previously. I don't know whether I'm making any sense whatsoever here.
You're making lots of sense. And I would add in that actually it doesn't always show in dialogue. So children can internalize meaning and learning and stuff that they can't yet articulate.
Yes.
But they can still have articulated, they can still have absorbed and processed an interaction. A boundary, for example, because one of the things we haven't got onto yet with reason is boundaries, you know. You can create a relationship with a child where you just look at them a certain way and they feel safe, but they feel pulled right up to a boundary.
Yeah.
And there's no dialogue. But if you pause with that moment and the right body language and you are in that sweet spot, it's a really, really powerful moment.
Mm.
And I've done that a few times, but because my job doesn't really involve that. My job is taking children out and meeting them where they're at. I don't often have to get myself into, I suppose I do. It's the fact that I'm avoiding standoffs. And that's what we all need to be thinking about is in a standoff, nobody wins. So there's no point when sort of expanding a bit on boundaries, since we've touched on that, is that, we get very hung up that we have to have boundaries. And I agree. Everybody agrees. I don't think there's anybody out there that doesn't agree that boundaries are important, you know. But they need to be value-based boundaries.
Yeah.
You know, they need to be about safety and healthy development and those sort of things, by my mind, rather than punitive and unnecessary boundaries, you know. You're using the wrong pencil or whatever, you're not allowed to leave the class with your maths book. So the kid's like, oh, okay, I'll leave without it.
I think it's interesting, this conversation about boundaries, because I think you're right. We have to have boundaries within the classroom, but it's the way that we first of all explain those boundaries and then enforce those boundaries so that children understand that the boundaries aren't there for punitive reasons. They are there to keep them safe. They are there. But basically, they're creating that safe space that is absolutely vital and allows children then to know where they can go up to. And as you said, it's about that look. It's about the children knowing, oh, no, I can't. You know, and I'm a great believer in explaining to children where the boundaries are, because then they know.
And there's a spectrum to boundaries. I talked about SOP. In the first podcast, you know, damage to self, others and properties, which is usually a really urgent and essential boundary.
Mm.
But there's a whole spectrum to boundaries, you know.
Absolutely.
So some boundaries, I remember my toddler son walking out between parked cars, you know, and he went quicker than I thought. And I shouted, no, and I grabbed him on the arm really hard, pulled him back. It was very slow, but there was a car coming. And the shock on his face, because that was, you know, a loud no, and it probably hurt his arm. Mm. But in that moment, it was a necessary response for his own safety.
Mm.
But we overuse that simplistic and extreme way of holding a boundary. And then it becomes inappropriate in itself. And we cannot in communities have enough bandwidth for that amount of no's and being hurt. Do you know what I mean? Whether it's, you know, emotionally or physically hurt. Some of the punitive stuff that we do is emotionally unhealthy.
What I would suggest with your son is that when you said no, actually, he was probably quite shocked at number one, you saying no, and number one, you using the volume that you did. And that's because that's not the way you would normally communicate with him. And that's why it's so important that we don't communicate with our children like that regularly, so that they do know that when something is really, really, really serious, we are going to be different. And actually, that probably sat with your son because he was like, oh, that's an absolute boundary I must never cross again. I must never go between two parked carts. But I think if people are using a volume and using the word no repeatedly, it has much less effect, doesn't it?
It has less effect in terms of shaping understanding. It has less effect even at shaping behaviour, which is what it's designed for.
Yeah.
But it has quite an effect on actually pressing the button on their stress systems.
Yes. Yeah.
So, you know, the yes, no exercise I do in my training, where I walk around saying yes really softly and then I walk around saying no quite harshly. And everybody has, you know, their eyes closed and they're relaxed. And I ask them just to notice what occurs in your body and your thoughts. It's a Dan Siegel thing, by the way. And then I ask them to raise their hands who noticed the difference between the two conditions. And more than 95% of the hands always go up, because I always spend that, you know, when you do that thing as a trainer and you think this will be the day. But even if it doesn't, there's still interesting things in there. But it is nearly always 95% of the hands go up. They noticed a difference in their body and in their thoughts when I just changed the tone of my voice in a safe setting where they knew I was doing an exercise. You know, actually being in the proximity of that kind of boundary setting causes anxiety and stress responses for everybody. And it's what are the individual bandwidths, and are we chipping away at somebody who doesn't have much of a bandwidth anyway? That we also need to be taking into consideration.
Absolutely. Now, I want to go on to Dan Siegel quickly. I know I'm going up another lane, but you mentioned at the beginning of the podcast to me, actually pre-recording the podcast, you mentioned Dan Siegel and his parenting thing. So what was that? Because I want to know.
Oh, just because hopefully this will make you laugh, right?
Oh, good. Well, I like a good laugh.
Yeah, you have to be able to laugh at yourself, though, okay? Because...
Oh, I'm good at that. Regularly do that.
I found this, when I read this, I found this hilarious. Okay, so quite a long time ago, I read, there's a book called No Drama Discipline. Mm-hmm. It's by Dan Siegel and Tina Payne Bryson. And this is when I was first looking at things about, you know, different ways to have boundaries, okay? So this is up in our reason stage, isn't it? Because we're talking about discipline here. He reframes the word discipline at the beginning of the book. But anyway, at the end of the book, there is a section called 20 Discipline Mistakes That Every Great Parent Makes, right?
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, you know, I'm not a bad parent. I'm saying necessarily I'm perfect, by a long way. But, you know, if a great parent makes these, I'm sure I'm going to see a few. Oh, my gosh. You look at them, you're like, yep. And you're like, oh, yeah, I think I've made all of those. But actually, they are really good reflection tools. So shall I just give you a quick whiz of them?
Okay.
Yeah. How many of these out of 20 have you made a mistake of? And, of course, this can be as a teacher, because obviously anything about parenting could be teaching. You know, it's a relationship. So these are the mistakes that Dan Siegel and Tina Payne Bryson say that we will have made. Maybe not all the time, but we will have made. Number one, our discipline becomes consequence-based instead of teaching-based. Well, yeah, I think we all fall into that. We think that if we're disciplining, we can't be warm and nurturing.
Ooh.
Yep. Three, we confuse consistency with rigidity. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We talk too much. I have to give myself 3 ticks for that one. I get more ticks for that than any other.
Yes, because, yeah, that's,
I like to
that's
talk.
Weird. I definitely do that as a parent. And eventually my daughter said to me the other day, she said, Mum, you've now been talking about that for 10 minutes.
And also as well, when there's a stressful situation, our language processing fades a bit anyway, because we're dealing with threat, you know, psychologically speaking. So actually we're using language at completely the wrong time anyway, usually. Language is for when you're in that sweet spot and you can build language in.
Mm.
But when we're, and I use a vignette with parents and I'll say, you know, your 4-year-old is driving you bananas because she never comes away from her game and gets ready when you've got to go out through the front door. And, you know, I said, and you're there going, come on, got to do it. You got to, because do you know what? We've got to go to the shop because the shop's about to close, because we've got to get your ballet skirt, because you've got your dress rehearsal tomorrow. And if you don't make your dress rehearsal, they might not let you be in the actual show, which is next week. And that's grandma's birthday present. She's going to be really disappointed if you're not in the show next week. And actually, whoa, we've included so much in that. The empathy for grandma, the long-term planning, the task switching and flexibility, all of these, and they're all higher thinking, you know, skills. And we've used a hell of a lot of language really fast to convey all those higher thinking skills across to you. And you're four. And actually, you haven't managed task switching because you find it difficult to put your game down. So, yeah, there's one that I think you can reflect on. But they're all worth thinking about. We focus too much on the behaviour and not enough on the why behind the behaviour. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also that thing whereby we follow that trail. So basically we pull a child up for something and say, look, you know what, we need to talk about whatever. And they go, no, I didn't, he did, or whatever, and blah. And then they do something else. And they say, no, listen to me. And they go, I don't want to listen to you. And you go, and you end up talking to them about not listening to you, yeah? And then they walk out of the classroom. You say, no, don't walk away. You end up talking about them walking away. You're actually not even, they move you so far from the original thing anyway. Do you know what I mean? We might as well be thinking about a little bit about why we're here, yeah? And remember Dan's thing, to be accepting, curious and empathic, and that's how you'll get to that. Where are we? Next one is we forget to focus on how we say what we say. Language leads meaning, you know, and I think language leading meaning, there's loads of lovely psychology stuff on this, you know, especially in the court systems, it's actually quite scary as well, how all sorts of things lead meaning. But language leads meaning. And the tone and the body language and all of this communication, you know, leaks. So, yeah, I think that's one that we could always use. We communicate that our kids shouldn't experience big or negative feelings. Which goes back to what I was saying earlier on about toxic positivity. It's also to do with resources and bandwidth. We haven't really got the time for their difficult stuff.
Yeah.
We haven't got the emotional bandwidth for their difficult stuff. And sometimes that's a fact. But if we are constantly not allowing them to have those difficult feelings, that's not healthy. We overreact, so our kids focus on our overreaction, not their own actions. We don't repair. Circles of rupture and repair, all relationships will rupture. It's normal. The healthy part is how they repair. And very often we move on, and when everything's sweet, we don't want to go back to it because everything's sweet right now. Let's not go back there. But actually the repair, if it's not done, means that you've got loose ends and they will just trigger again much quicker. So, yeah, we don't repair. Okay, we lay down the law in an emotional reactive moment. And then realise we've actually overreacted.
Yes.
Because we didn't do the first part in the 3 R's. We didn't regulate ourselves first. We forget that our children may sometimes need our help making what we call good choices or calming themselves down. And I would say it's not that they sometimes need our help. If they have never had that, they can't do that. It's a precursor to being able to make good choices, calm yourself down. You have to have been supported through I hate the term good choices, but what somebody else might call a good choice. You have to be helped through that process in the ways that we've already talked about. Calming themselves down is only possible if they've experienced enough co-regulation. That's an experience that they've had or not had. And if they haven't experienced co-regulation, then they're not going to be able to self-regulate because that hasn't been internalized. It's a skill and it's a map. So we need to consider whether or not, you know, we have got that skill in front of us because they aren't necessarily able to do it.
Mm-hmm.
The other one, this is a good one. We consider an audience when we're disciplining. And I had a mum once and she worked with me and she came back and she said, oh, I had a complete meltdown. I think they were on a pier. They'd gone to the beach. He had a complete meltdown, blah, blah, blah. And I did everything you said and I stayed really calm. And yet, you know, it didn't seem to be enough and blah, blah, blah. And then we unpack it, you see, and that's what I sort of do in my support, you know. So I give them sort of a bit of a framework to practice, bring it back, unpack it. I said, okay. I said, well done for all of, you know, those bits and, you know, this bit. And it sounds like that worked well and it sounds like you. And I said, but, you know, and then she said there were people watching. And I said, how did it feel to have people watching? And she said, oh, God, it was awful. It was so embarrassing. Mm-hmm. And I went, so you weren't actually calm, though. Do you know what I mean? You were actually really self-conscious about them and their opinions and really stressed about that. And I said, and although you managed maybe not to shout and you were aware of not being calm, their opinion still held you back from being truly focused on the needs of the moment. Mm. And she was like, ah, yeah, we do. It's the whole thing about the meltdown in the aisle at the supermarket, isn't it?
It's so tricky. It really is. And I always feel for parents who have children having meltdowns, because I've been there. You know, my daughter at the age of, I think it was two, went did a sort of spread eagle in the middle of Boots. And I remember just thinking, oh, God, can you not? Really? And, you know, and you've got, and there are certain people that will stop and watch to see how you deal with it. Yeah. And then you've got other people who I put myself amongst those people that just feel this real empathy of, oh, God, I've been there. I'm so sorry that you were in that space. And I think it is really tricky because, you know, it is like being on TV, being filmed, having, you know, so how are they going to deal with this? It's awful. It really is. And I think it is very, very tricky to remain calm within that scenario when we think we're being watched.
And we also get triggered into, are we good enough? I was having a conversation. Yeah. I did some training with a whole staff earlier this week, actually. And we were talking about emotional regulation, but we were actually talking about it on a staff level. And actually, one of the things we were talking about is when we reach our bandwidth, you know, we're possibly not able to go to the next level with that child. We might need to just tap out.
Mm.
And how you do that and the practicalities of all that, you know. But what that brought up is, I'll be judged. Do you know what I mean? Because I didn't handle it brilliantly. I wasn't perfect. You know, I couldn't cope, you know. Mm. I don't have those skills. And, you know, and we really started to unpack that. It brings being watched, you know. But think about the children, you know what I mean? We are watching them and their peers are watching them all the time.
Yeah, so, absolutely. Now, I'm conscious of time, Heather, so we're going to have to speed through these last few.
Sure, there is a few. Shall I put them on the link?
That would be great, because I think, you know, what's really interesting is every single one I have nodded along to.
But yeah, they all bring up something, don't they? Which is why I love them.
Yeah, there was one that was really triggering for me, actually, and I'm going to share this, listeners, which is, it was something about, you know, not being allowed to express big emotions, etc. Because I remember my dad, you know, as a little girl, I was told that crying was a sign of weakness. He used to quote John Wayne. Now, I've just looked up the quote. John Wayne never said crying was a sign of weakness, but my dad used to say it. John Wayne said everything. So he used to say, John Wayne says crying is a sign of weakness. So I was not given permission to cry because that was seen as a sign of weakness. And that was... You know, it's those sort of things that are really tricky because you grow up with those messages. And it took me a long time to realize that crying isn't a sign of weakness at all, that actually crying is a sign of strength. Learning to cry is okay. But it's really interesting just listening to what you've said, Heather, about those messages that we've received as children, those messages that we've received through training, those messages that we have received through the schools that we work in, and actually recognizing who we are as teachers and what we need to do for the children in our classes.
It's a lot, isn't it?
It's an awful lot, isn't it?
But this is why I always go back to sequence the complexity, because there comes a point where it's infinite, and then the danger is it feels overwhelming and we just give up, we stop. So don't do that. Just go back, sequence your complexity, and look at a model like regulate, relate, reason, a framework like being ACE or PACE, and sitting in the moment, and a few tools like that, and just go back to those achievable chunks, and that will get you back on track.
I think that's so powerful. It really is. Now, listeners, there is so much in the show notes for both episodes that Heather's put in with regards to links for further reading, things that she's touched on and so on. So do have a look at those and just remember to sequence the complexity. Thank you so much, Heather, for coming on for a second time and just giving us unbelievable amounts of information. I found it. I mean, honestly, you should see my book. It's just filled with information. Any last thoughts?
No, just that if anybody does want to carry on any conversation with me, this, as I think you can tell, is what I adore. you know, discussing, reflecting on, sharing, and learning from others as well. Do you know what I mean? So anybody out there wants to make contact with me informally just to chat, you know, any, I just love it at all. So please do email me questions that you've got. You know, I may not have answers. It's not always about having the answers. Sometimes it's about, you know, bouncing things off each other and opening up thought patterns. But, you know, if I can have conversations with people about this stuff, I'm normally the most enthusiastic person. So please do email me, contact me. I'm on Twitter. And yeah, we'll carry on the conversations. Thank you for letting me start them on here.
Oh, thank you so much, Heather. Loved having you on.
Thank you. You are a star.